I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be looking at the issue of multiple global crises and understanding them through the lens of systems thinking with Dr. Nafees Ahmed, author of A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Dr. Ahmed initially came to prominence writing about the War on Terror and 9/11. We'll discuss that at the beginning of our conversation before delving into his work on systems thinking, crises like climate change, the issue of identity politics, global disinformation networks, and potential solutions for the crises we face, like climate change. Also, the potential for a post-capitalist future. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views with the fascinating Dr. Nafees Ahmed. You can check out his work now at Byline Times, where he is a special investigations reporter. Also, be sure to check out his book, A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. He also has a documentary called The Crisis of Civilization from 2011, and has also done some rather interesting writing at Vice. So be sure to check all of that out, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Nafees Ahmed on global crises and systems thinking. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest whose work I've been following since my teenage years. I'm now going on 30. I've been reading your work for a long time. Dr. Nafees Ahmed of the Byline Times, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Ahmed, I'd like to talk about some of your current work, but I was interested in maybe starting with your work as it pertains to the War on Terror and issues like 9/11. I think that some people have misunderstood your work in that area and maybe how it connects to the work you're doing today. Could you just give maybe a brief outline for my listeners that are new to your work about your writings on 9/11 and the War on Terror?
Yeah, absolutely. So, my first book was about 9/11. It was a kind of critical investigation of the official narrative around the 9/11 attacks. I think that, the big thing with that is it kind of set the agenda for what a lot of the 9/11 families were concerned about. They were calling for an investigation. Since then, my interest kind of went further into trying to understand kind of the power dynamics and the institutional networks that allowed this attack to happen. I think the way in which some of this work has been confused is that is really in this space between what people describe as conspiracy theory and what I kind of see as kind of systems analysis.
I was going to add real quick, if I could. I think it was unfair that certain commentators, I believe Jonathan Kay, tried to say you were involved with the 9/11 truth movement and sort of putting you in the same basket as someone like David Icke, who you've been extremely critical of. And I think that has been unfair to you because your work on 9/11 has been very different than what people usually associate with the so-called 9/11 truth.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never kind of actually considered myself a part of the 9/11 truth movement or anything like that. But I mean, obviously at the time in my book was, I think it was the first kind of major book that had raised questions about the official narrative and did so in a way that seemed quite credible. I interviewed some really serious people. I mean, I interviewed people like David Shippers, you know, the former prosecutor who was involved in, you know, the whole impeachment of Bill Clinton and stuff, and, you know, coming out talking about how he'd been approached by FBI agents prior to the attacks in the 3 months, who said that they'd been tracking some of the 9/11 hijackers in the United States and were blocked by the FBI. They had come to him because they wanted help to basically deal with this. So this was, kind of dealing with kind of serious facts about what kind of went wrong. How is it that this happened? And of course, at the time, you know, people ran with it and people made it what they wanted, and they, you know, kind of, were kind of pigeonholed this kind of line of inquiry and this line of analysis into, oh, the 9/11 truth movement, blah, blah, blah. And it's quite frustrating because actually the problem with the 9/11 truth movement is that mode of thinking, that specific conspiratorial mode of drawing conclusions is highly simplistic and can often mean that you don't really understand the complexity of what's going on. There are many different scenarios that could explain some of these anomalies. I think the most important thing, the most basic kind of, I guess, theoretical framework that seemed to emerge from the work I was doing and the work that some other people were doing as well, like Peter Del Scott, for instance, and several other kind of authors who were also, you know, not really interested in kind of conspiracy theories, but really wanted to understand what Peter Del Scott called, deep politics, this kind of interesting intersection between organized crime, the invisible kind of structures of organized crime, and the kind of the visible structures of the democratic state, and what he would call deep events, when these structures really kind of intertwine, and things we then see that manifested in kind of these anomalous kind of events, or these assassinations, or terrorism, or things that we don't quite kind of understand. And so my essential argument was that the events leading up to 9/11, and which continues really, I think, to be a major problem for the national security kind of complex, is that our governments had this strategy of working with various Islamist groups for a very long time, and in some cases also working with state sponsors of Islamist groups. So, for instance, I mean, and this is quite well known, I mean, and it's not very controversial when we talk about the Cold War. You know, we all know that, you know, there was a policy of working with the Mujahideen, to kind of counter Russian influence in Afghanistan and all the rest of it.
Was that Operation Cyclone?
Operation Cyclone, and there were loads of other stuff going on around that time. And one of the things that happened during that period that is quite, again, not very controversial, is, you know, we worked with some really, some people that we now are quite worried about, you know. So, for example, there's lots of concerns about the Muslim Brotherhood and their role in politics and their role in certain parts of the Muslim world. But the funny thing is that the Muslim Brotherhood, around that time, when it, you know, in its heyday, you know, the CIA was working and talking to the Brotherhood, and essentially, in many ways, helping them as a kind of to use them as a kind of like a bulwark against Russian and Soviet kind of efforts to move into some of these countries. And Islamism was seen as essentially a counterweight to Russian expansionism in many parts of the world. And that's one of the reasons why we had so much money poured into these things. And it was a combination of things, you know, some of this was very visible and a lot of it was very covert. And that obviously had a massive impact, and one of the impacts was seen, you know, when we see in Afghanistan, we, you know, some of the things I've seen were terrible stories of, you know, even in madrasas where they were teaching children, you know, like the Taliban would be teaching children or, you know, this kind of extremist material. I mean, even the textbooks that they were using were sometimes funded by the CIA, and that funding had been funneled through Pakistani intelligence services, which had then gone down to various militant groups, which had then gone down to these madrasas. So it was one of these kind of very crazy kind of whirlwinds of activity. And but what isn't well known is that much of this activity also kind of recalibrated and continued after the Cold War. And we found, you know, a lot of my work, the work of other analysts like my colleague Mark Curtis, who he currently runs the investigative journalism platform Declassified, where we break a lot of stories on British foreign policy. So myself and several other analysts who've been looking at this have shown how both Britain and the United States continue to use Islamist groups as allies after the Cold War, and even in Afghanistan throughout the 1990s. I mean, Afghanistan is a great example of this because it takes us straight into kind of the war on terror and 9/11. You know, the CIA and the United States and Britain were involved in financing the Taliban's expansion across Afghanistan through the 1990s, providing them weapons, training. And this is now really well documented. And they were doing this because they saw the Taliban at that time as potentially providing, you know, in the hopes that it would eventually take over Afghanistan, a kind of like a modicum of stability that would allow the one of the goals of this process, apart from there were many geostrategic kind of interests in seeing Afghanistan as a kind of a stabilization point and an entry point into Central Asia. But there were also some specific interests around, I mean, and again, this is now well known. It's been well documented by the Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, you know, in his several books he's written about the interests of Unocal, the big oil company that is kind of now defunct, and also Enron, you know, in establishing a kind of a pipeline transshipment route across Afghanistan. And needing a stable entity to allow that to take place. You know, and there were, you know, US diplomats and officials who Ahmed Rashid had spoken to, for example, who, you know, off the record told him quite candidly that, you know, this is really about getting, you know, getting some kind of an Islamist regime that is gonna provide stability for the pipelines. And, you know, to hell with human rights effectively. So this kind of really leads us into, you know, how did we get to 9/11? Well, we got to 9/11 because so much of the institutional infrastructure was wedded to these networks and these groups. And in fact, we had a whole industry that had developed around actually shielding and concealing the role of the Saudis, the Pakistanis, you know, the Turks, Azerbaijan, all of these different state sponsors that had various roles in facilitating the movements of some various kind of groups and networks in their own context, of course. And all of this had to be kind of, you know, we didn't really want this to become public. We didn't want people to understand what was going on. And also the kind of the blowback element of this is that all of these networks, obviously many of them were actually linked to terrorist organizations. You know, the Taliban was harboring Osama bin Laden at some point in time. It was harboring what eventually became known as Al-Qaeda. And those people in those networks obviously had their ideology, they had their agenda, and they had a view of what they wanted to do. And they had networks and they were actively trying to get, you know, they had people that were trying to infiltrate the United States or Britain, planning terrorist plots. So the problem that we had is that, of course, we had these large national security structures and these alliances and relationships with these networks. But at the same time, you know, we had these groups planning and trying to do things. Now, that overall kind of blockage on the national security system meant that some of these groups, we weren't able to, our agencies weren't able to properly investigate and follow through. They found that when they did so, there was political immunity, there were political blocks, there were, oh, we can't investigate groups that are connected to the Saudis. oh, we can't investigate groups that are connected to these guys, or we can't investigate these guys. They suddenly had this inexplicable immunity. So my view is that this kind of context provides us some explanation of why it is that we had, you know, these 9/11 hijackers, for example, running around in the United States, you know, under surveillance, you know, masses of information coming in to the intelligence agencies, but inexplicably were blocked. Why it is that we had these top-down orders from, you know, FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., or, you know, top orders from the State Department to stop looking at certain groups. And I think you know, there was definitely this politicization of the intelligence process, and things really broke down. And that's a kind of a fairly simplistic way of looking at it. You know, I think there was a lot more complexity going on. I think, you know, we had multiple interest groups. I think one of the kind of intriguing areas of this is when you look, for example, at the collapse of Air Defense on 9/11. And, you know, like the 9/11 Commission found that there were, you know, weird blips on the radar that were turning up and kind of flights being misdirected and what was going on. It seemed really strange. And again, you know, a lot of the kind of earlier kind of conspiracy theorists looking at this were looking and saying, oh, this is evidence of, you know, direct kind of manipulation. And, you know, President Bush was involved in doing this or whatever. And rather than seeing that, I think there was what was more interesting and much more revealing by the fact that the 9/11 Commission didn't want to look at this was the role of organizations like PTEC, which was, you know, linked to someone who was connected. I think I can't remember the name, so I won't make an error and kind of, you know, libel someone, but connected directly to someone who was involved with financing Al-Qaeda, had links to the Bin Laden family, was already under investigation for terrorism links. And PTEC at the same time was a major kind of government contractor, you know, working with the FAA and working with very sensitive agencies in the Pentagon and elsewhere. And so had access to some of the most sensitive kind of infrastructure in the United States. And somehow PTEC, you know, just completely missed. We didn't have any serious investigation into this bizarre kind of connection that was going on. And it makes you wonder then, so what was going on? But again, I think, so this kind of looking in that direction, you begin to see that there were all sorts of explanations going on. And there's certainly, we can see this nexus of kind of organized criminal activity, engaging with Islamist militants, all sorts of things going on, you know, heroin trafficking, you know, geopolitical interests, which created this overall nexus of vulnerability that essentially allowed, in my view, allowed these kind of terrorists to carry out and execute 9/11 attacks, and essentially it emasculated the national security system and prevented it from being able to respond. Now that paradigm, I'm convinced, continues to exist today, that because nothing has been done fundamentally to really kind of lay bare the workings of these structures. And that is what has made us increasingly vulnerable to terrorist activity. It's what's allowed groups like ISIS to eventually emerge, pave the way for kind of the proliferation of militant groups and extremist ideology. And it leads us to, you know, it's led to further terrorist attacks. And it's led us to where we are today, which is this very confused kind of situation where we have difficulties kind of exploring and understanding. So I think the point, what I've tried to do with this work is really bring a kind of more systemic lens to understanding how these things work. And that's not to say that there aren't conspiracies going on within the context of these systems. You know, there are groups of people who are, you know, planning and actively planning specific things. But what I think is often forgotten is that there's not necessarily one gigantic cabal and an overarching conspiracy to say, oh, you know, so-and-so all got together to plan 9/11, for instance. But actually what's more likely to be happening is these multiple different groups of you know, whether it's militant groups or groups in the FBI or groups in the Justice Department with their varying agendas, you know, working towards various types of, you know, illicit activity essentially, which was dangerous for the system and which needed to be shut down. And this ended up creating a system, an overall overarching system, a deep system you might say, which has created this nexus that we can't see, where this kind of intersection between national security state and criminal and militant activity has allowed terrorist attacks to happen.
I wanted to move on to some other topics you've been covering, but one more question which pertains to 9/11. I think it's interesting. I feel like you focus on aspects of 9/11 that really, like we said earlier, the sort of truth movement doesn't focus on. And I wanted to say I've had Peter Dill Scott on the show to talk about a lot of these issues. And I feel like people are better served by looking at things that you've discussed, like, say, Pakistan ISI, than, you know, what brought down the trade centers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the biggest thing I have with this issue is that the problem with looking at physical evidence is that, you know, there's this assumption that once you have a certain amount of physical evidence, it proves this particular hypothesis. And it actually doesn't. Like, even if you show that there was a controlled demolition, which actually I think is, you know, I'm really, really, really questioning, you know, that the evidence that's been put forward in that basis. I'm not convinced at all. You know, I think there are some really important anomalies and important questions that need to be asked. Does it prove a controlled demolition? I'm not sure. I know there's going to be loads of people who disagree with that. But I'm not convinced by some of the kind of scientists that have come forward and the work that they've done. And I've seen and spoken to, you know, mechanical engineers and physicists who have given me really plausible and compelling refutations of that work to show that some of it is really sloppy. But that's not to say that there aren't still important questions. You know, there are questions. You know, I mean, there's testimony of firefighters who said that they heard explosions, sequences of explosions in the towers and things like that. So, you know, I'm open to, I think all of this evidence needs to be on the table, we need to explore it. But does it automatically prove a particular hypothesis? And this is really the thing where I think, you know, both sides, wherever you stand, they kind of forget that actually just because you prove one thing, it doesn't mean that you've shown that there's this grand conspiracy. There's all sorts of explanations for why, for example, a controlled demolition for like a collapse of the towers or could have been covered up. What if a controlled demolition, for example, was undertaken by terrorists who were somehow getting access to the towers, and that there was a very specific type of national security failure that allowed that to happen? One that isn't the same as saying, oh, this was a plan that President Bush hatched, you know, but actually something else might have happened. So it's very important that people investigating things need to look and think about the chains of complicity and what the evidence base is for saying that somebody is responsible for a crime. How is this actually going to stand in a court of law? What does it actually mean? And that's really important, because when you do that, you realize that a lot of the theorizing that's going on in the 9/11 truth movement is so full of these fundamental gaps that, in the same way that they might say that, well, look at the problems with the gaps around that, you know, Osama bin Laden and his involvement and blah, 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 and the lack of evidence and blah, blah, blah. But the same questions apply very equally, if not more so, to, you know, saying that President Bush was complicit and organized the 9/11 attacks. I mean, that's a really, really big claim. To what extent can you really prove that is the chain of evidence that we have, the paper trail that leads to that level of complicity? There's nothing like that available. So that's why my focus is really on, let's look at the institutional networks, let's look at the systems, let's look at the infrastructure, let's look at this wider issues to really understand this phenomenon. Because of course, it's not just about 9/11, you know, there is a wider continuum here of this phenomenon of Islamist terrorism and other kinds of terrorism. And we need to understand this more broadly. And that's the other thing, I think, you know, it's about really trying to, you know, widen the lens to see what's kind of going on in this, in general, as a wider kind of phenomenon. I think, you know, we had, I think Lance DeHaven Smith, a professor at political science at Florida State University, has come up with this concept of state crimes against democracy. And, you know, try to move away from the more kind of conspiratorial mode to say that, look, it's about trying to see patterns in state crimes which undermine democracy, and to see how that exposes kind of networks of power, you know, kind of organized criminal activity, that kind of thing, and to see whether what those patterns tell us about how power is operating, rather than trying to take a single event and explain it and then say, oh, well, it's just this particular cabal or particular group of people, which in the end, you know, ends up often being just a rabbit hole or a dead end.
Now, in regards to how this ties into your current work, you really are covering issues related to collapse, whether social or environmental, really the crisis of civilization, rising violence, racism, disinformation, climate crisis. Do you think there's a connection between what you wrote about with the war on terror and these sort of rolling crises that are all coalescing right now in our current moment?
Absolutely. I think definitely, I think with my, when I wrote my book, The User's Guide to Crisis Civilization, this really kind of hit home to me. And that book, I attempted to really bring together in a systems lens how all of these crises are really part of a fundamental kind of system. You know, so, you know, I looked at climate change, energy, food, the economy, and I looked at terrorism and conflict and, you know, state militarization. And I think, you know, this was the first book that attempted to really integrate all of these things together. And one of the biggest insights that I had is how all of these crises kind of boil down to the operation of this wider system, which is fundamentally dependent on a particular type of energy. You know, hydrocarbon energy forms, fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, and the centralized control of those forms of energy, and the way in which the whole kind of geopolitics has kind of evolved.
You cut out there for a second. I think you were saying the way in which the whole of geopolitics is that.
That's right. The whole kind of the whole international structure of this whole structure of international geopolitics, the way that's evolved, especially in the kind of the post-war period, but been kind of very heavily tied to the control of specific energy sources and led to a particular type of economy. And all of these things are really fundamentally interlinked. So when we're looking at things like 9/11 and Islamist groups, one of the kind of consistent themes that emerges from that and kind of the trajectory of Anglo-American foreign policy is this interest in controlling and dominating the world's fossil fuel resources. And that's something which I think has become really clear, and it's come clear from declassified documents, you know, from the State Department, from the British Foreign Office. We can absolutely see that this has been a real driving kind of factor in the way in which our policy has developed. And at the same time, what we've seen is that the vast bulk of the world's fossil fuel resources have been kind of concentrated in these predominantly Muslim regions of the Middle East, Central Asia, North Africa. And so we've seen that the geopolitics of this has led us to kind of accelerate many of these interventions in these parts of the world. So we've had this acceleration of covert activity, of overt military activity in parts of the Middle East and North Africa. You know, and we can see that mapped out in the military bases. We can see it in the history of the recent interventions, especially, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, ongoing involvement in other areas, in Yemen, in Syria, and so on and so forth, in Somalia. Across the board, we can find these interconnections with direct access to countries with heavy oil and gas resources, or countries which are very geopolitically strategically kind of positioned in relation to transshipment routes for oil and gas. So that's clearly a very important thing. And what's, of course, driving all of this is this overarching global kind of neoliberal economy, which is kind of symbiotically entwined with its dependence on kind of cheap kind of fossil fuels. And it's this cyclical relationship where, you know, in order to keep our economy is growing, we need to kind of accelerate our resource throughput, and our resource throughput happens to be kind of cheap fossil fuels. So we keep expanding that, And then as we expand that, that enables further growth and expansion. And so we have this ongoing process. So what's really interesting to me here is how you have this fossil fuel system, you have this wider neoliberal kind of endless growth economy that's premised on that and enabled by it. You have this geopolitical structure, which involves attempting to kind of dominate and control those kind of fossil fuels that are central to the operation of that system. And then, of course, you have the symptoms of this, which is the problems within the energy system that are increasingly worsening. You have the carbon emissions that are emitted by this system, which result in the acceleration of climate change. And you then have the kind of the feedback effects of those crises and how they impact the food system, which is also heavily dependent on fossil fuels, industrial agriculture, and how you then have these multiplying kind of crises across climate, food, the economy, and energy, which all kind of work together. So you have this kind of multifaceted crisis, and it's all one system. And it's when you apply that system's lens, you begin to see that, wow, all of this really is deeply interconnected. So it was really my interest in systems that kind of led me to be so interested in understanding terrorism. And obviously, as a British Muslim as well, you know, I had a personal kind of sense of wanting to kind of understand, as someone who's been impacted by, the policies of the war on terror and so on and so forth. But I think it's when we take that bigger picture lens, we begin to see that actually, the reason all of these crises are accelerating at the same time is precisely because they are part of the same system. It's a system which is in crisis.
So in regards to the social aspects of this, you've covered the issue of Syria and the rise of ISIS and this issue of radicalization. It feels like a lot of this is now coming home, at least in places like the U.S. I mean, we just had the Capitol riots on January 6th. Are a lot of things that we're seeing outside of countries like the U.S. now coming home in sort of a different form? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think part of the problem is that a lot of the – I mean, one of the things that we see when we look at radicalization process, when we look at violent movements that resort to violence, whether it's a militia or a militant group, or it's a government or a state, is we see a similar process that's consistent all the time. And it's first of all, there is a sense of crisis, usually a sense of something being a kind of a status quo being put at risk. And that perception of crisis can take different forms, but when you within that perception of crisis, often one of the solutions or the way of resolving it is basically a kind of a construction of the other, kind of an identification of this is the problem. That problem is the source of what's driving this crisis. And often what happens is that problem is identified in obviously in relation to the context. If it's a government planning a military intervention, it will be, well, that's a particular country or a particular nation that is problematic and we need to take this kind of action. If it's a group like ISIS, it will be, well, it's the non-Muslims, it's the West, it's blah, blah, blah. That's the problem. And if it's the far right, then it will be, oh, it's the immigrants, it's the Muslims, it's the asylum seekers, or it's Black people or Jewish people, who they are the problem, who are coming in and they're upsetting the status quo, which is the white kind of white majority or whatever it is, however they see it. So that's a consistent thing that we see. And I think what's happening now is we're finding ourselves in this situation where as these underlying systemic crises, these very fundamental systemic crises are accelerating. And these are to do with the fundamental kind of biophysical structures that underpin our system. You know, we've got this energy crisis where, you know, we talk about energy return on investment, which essentially very simply is how much energy you're using to get energy out. And what we're seeing is that we're using more and more energy to get this kind of decreasing amount of energy out. So the energy system is becoming more and more inefficient. And that's and how are we dealing with that? Well, we're using debt, we're financing, we're throwing debt money at the problem, as we've always done. And that's making the problem worse. It's setting ourselves up for a deeper crisis. And this deeper crisis, obviously, this fundamental dependence is also, you know, we have the climate problem, which is getting worse. We have these incumbent industries, which are kind of, you know, they have, you know, their wealth and their power are systemically kind of dependent on maintaining this existing system and this existing structure. So they don't want people to change things. So they're putting out all this disinformation about climate change and talking about, they don't want any kind of regulation of the markets or anything like that. They just want to keep the show going. And within that context, obviously the reality, the problem is that things, so, you know, things are getting worse. You know, the economy is getting more unstable. Debt is increasing. You know, even after the last financial crisis, we've gone back to the same business as usual approach, and the amount of debt within the system is even bigger than it was before the 2008 financial crash. Some, you know, this is, this kind of thing is going to keep on reverberating out. And obviously now we've had the pandemic, which was also a symptom of this increasing encroachment of our system into natural ecosystems, where, you know, we've ended up, you know, encroaching further and further into wildlife, human settlements and wildlife, increasing their contact. And this has increased the chances of the release of these kind of, you know, what they call zoonotic diseases, or diseases that are circulating amongst animals. These exotic, there's like thousands of these exotic diseases which we haven't encountered. And the more and more our human civilization is encroaching onto these kind of exotic kind of wildlife, the more chance there is of these crazy diseases coming into our tightly interlinked systems and kind of spreading. So, you know, what we've had really is kind of like a dry run for what could be a far worse pandemic in the near future or later this century. So that's the situation we're seeing, that we're in a system which is creating and generating and intensifying these multiple socioeconomic, environmental and political crises. Within that context, we have a very narrow frame of viewing things. Our incumbency doesn't see things systemically. It sees things from a narrow frame. And when you see things in a narrow frame, then that increases the kind of ability, the kind of the chances that you're going to come up with narrow solutions. So, you know, your narrow frame will kind of reduce everything to how it sees within that frame. So if your frame is a very kind of insulated, you know, whether you might be an Islamist militant or you might be a white supremacist, but you're going to have a very narrow ideological sense, which then says, based on my assumptions and my understanding of the world, and I see all these crises, well, I think the problem is, if I'm an Islamist, I think the problem is the West. It's the evil West, and this is what they're doing, and that's the problem. And obviously, if you're a white supremacist, you'll say, well, I think this is the problem. But what's happening is that as all of this is going on, all these systemic crises accelerating, we have the limits of our ideological lens, which is essentially allowing this kind of identity politics-based approach to proliferate. And it's leading to increasing polarization of our politics. And that's why we've seen in the last few years, certainly I'll say the last 5 years or so, this massive exponential acceleration. And I think all of us experience it, we can all see this, not only an exponential acceleration in just general chaos, like the speed of events is faster. You know, the speed of the news is just like, I mean, we've had 24-hour news for decades now, but what's happening in this decade, and specifically the last 5 years, where it's like every single day, it's everything's happening. It's climate, it's energy, it's Trump, it's the right wing, it's the left wing, it's woke, anti-woke, all of it on the same day, every day, for day after day. So that's the situation we're in now. And what we're seeing is this massive kind of polarization between, you know, culture, you know, this kind of culture war kind of myopic focus. And that's where the action is. That's where the politics is now. It's about, oh, you know, you said this, you said that, you're, you know, anti-woke or woke, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I consider myself to be, you know, on the progressive side, you know, leaning towards kind of left-wing thinking, you know, I'm very worried about the rise of the far right, but also really concerned about this general rise in identity politics in both the left and the right. You know, people talk about cancel culture and stuff like that. And while I think that, yeah, there's definitely a space to say, that we don't really, I don't really want to have idiot groups and fascists kind of taking over our public airwaves and our discourse. But I think it's really interesting how this issue of, you know, cancel culture and this, you know, woke wars and culture wars, this has become the defining battleground of our times, when the thing that's actually going to kill us is not that. It's the planetary crisis that is going on right now. And our weird, bizarre focus on those things is preventing us from responding effectively, intelligently, cohesively, coherently as a collective species to what is a collective crisis that's affecting all of us. And this, I think, is a really interesting thing. And a lot of my work now is about really trying to unpack. And it's difficult to do because, you know, you have to work across different kind of fields, but trying to unpack what's going on with this kind of the rise of this disinformation, and the kind of you have pandemic disinformation, you have far right disinformation, you've got all of this crazy stuff. Climate denialism, and it's all kind of melded into this crazy continuum. You know, it's kind of like pick your crazy belief that you want, and that's where the battleground has become. And we end up fighting fires. You know, I'm spending so much of my time as a journalist responding to and documenting bullshit. But when I don't want to be doing this. I want to be talking about the crisis. You know, what's really going on, and what's the solutions? What's the vision for the future? You know, how do we transition to and transform into a system that benefits everyone? You know, whatever your color, whatever your ideology, wherever you're from. What's the system that's going to work for all of us? That conversation isn't happening. Instead, you know, we're sucked into this really insidious and damaging type of conversation. So it's a really interesting. This is the symptom of the crisis. This growing cognitive inability to deal with and address and engage in the conversations that we need to, and instead being sucked into this weird vortex, I think is the kind of symptom that tells us that this is where we're at. We're on this brink and we have to find a way to get over it.
Just to stick on that point, this relationship between all these different crises, I think as these crises accelerate, they'll sort of bounce off each other, these different crises. For instance, when we look at catastrophic climate crisis, I could see the issue of climate refugees occurring, and that feeding into the problem of nativists here in the West. Do you see things like that continuing to accelerate, and there being maybe feedback loops between different kind of crises?
Absolutely. I think this is where we're really getting to the crux of how this thing is accelerating, and it's already happened. And I wrote about this a couple of years ago. I did a couple of pieces about the context for the Brexit vote and the rise of Trump. And what a lot of people aren't aware of is that the conflict in Syria had this kind of biophysical context. And, you know, there's an ongoing debate about which was more important, you know, the biophysical or the kind of the economic mismanagement by Bashar al-Assad. But what we do know is that there was a climate crisis in Syria. There was a drought cycle, a natural drought cycle that was made worse by climate change.
There were food shortages, right?
Yeah. So what essentially happened is the drought cycle some decades ago essentially exacerbated food shortages. And to some extent, I mean, I think there's an issue here of unpacking. You know, there are some political scientists who've said, well, some of this can be explained by Bashar al-Assad's economic mismanagement and the way that he was dealing with agriculture and farmers. But I think really, you know, we have to have a holistic approach and take both of those things to account. And there's no doubt that there was a climate impact, which was made far worse by climate change, the droughts. And over the overall result of this confluence of the Earth system crisis, you know, where you've had this climate change impact and the human system kind of corruption and economic mismanagement, was that, you know, agriculture essentially collapsed. And the result of these failures, farmers ended up, there was this exodus of farmers into kind of the other white centers of power. So these farmers were moving from the south, some several hundred thousand of them over several years, predominantly Sunni farmers moving into the kind of other white dominated coastal cities. And it kind of laid the groundwork for these sectarian tensions. And as a result of that, as we know, you know, history shows us, you know, that eventually the mismanagement took place within those, within the cities. You know, Bashar al-Assad's way of dealing with this thing was more repression. But it, I mean, the complexity of this thing is difficult to pin down. I mean, at the same time, I mean, that was around, you know, we're looking at around up to the 2000s. But in 2000, I think in 1996, Syria's domestic oil production, its conventional oil production, had peaked and began this consecutive decline. And this resulted in the Syrian state's kind of revenues also going down this decline. And as a result, you get to this point where from 2008, 2009, 2010, that they begin to shrink subsidies. So the government is stopping its spending on oil and food subsidies, which were really, really critical for a population which is, you know, primarily poor, who rely on these subsidies for their daily needs. At the same time, as we get, you know, from 2008 to 2011, you have this series of catastrophic climate events where, you know, droughts and floods around the world affect all the major food basket regions. So, you know, so I think India, South America, Russia, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you end up with this kind of gigantic food shortages, food price spikes. On top of that, you have the neoliberal financial speculation on these commodities. And you know, what we haven't mentioned is that in, you know, taking a bigger picture, you know, there was also the peak of global conventional oil, which happened, you know, certainly it plateaued around 2005.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I just wanted to add this in. I feel like there's going to be some listeners that are going to say, oh, they're talking about peak oil. And I think some people misunderstand what peak oil is, and they think, oh, wasn't that, you know, an issue that people talked about in the 2000s? No one talks about that anymore. It's not really an issue. But I think it still is an issue, and I think a lot of people don't understand. It's not necessarily about running out of oil. It's really about the returns we get from the money we spend to extract, correct?
Correct, absolutely. And that's a really important thing. I think there's definitely a case to be made that there was a very specific peak oil scenario that some peak oilers had put forward, where they'd said, you know, there's going to be this point where, and the way that had been put forward was this sense of, oh, it's running out of oil, and there's going to be this exponentially forever increasing kind of oil prices, you know, into the double digits, triple digits. And that's going to continue indefinitely, and that's going to collapse everything. And that was clearly wrong, some of the people who were saying that. But the fact is most of the experts who are talking about this didn't give forth such a simplistic and weird kind of binary bizarre scenario. They were actually talking about the economics of oil. And that analysis still has a lot of merit. And I've been doing a lot of reporting, and I've been doing this at Vice, you know, and several other publications, you know, previously doing it at The Guardian, talking about the economics of the oil industry. And that what's really happened, and what most oil industry experts agree on, is that we've shifted into this age of expensive energy in terms of the extraction process. So the costs of that production process have gone up at the well. That doesn't necessarily mean it's reflected in the market price, but it's happening at production. And so what's happened in 2005, what happened globally, is that conventional oil, we hit this plateau. And that's, you know, very, very clearly documented in numerous peer-reviewed sources and elsewhere, that we stopped kind of increasing the production of conventional oil. So it kind of hit a plateau. And when that happened, in order to kind of, obviously demand was still going up, so to meet demand, we relied on these more expensive forms of oil and gas, which essentially are unconventional forms of oil, you know, shale oil, shale gas, tar sands. So there's, you know, different types of these oil. And everyone knows that to get those types of oil out it's just a lot more complicated. You know, you need to kind of drill deeper, you know, pump water in. You know, hydrofracturing is a more expensive and difficult process, and a more environmentally problematic process. Sorry, I've got so much noise going on in the background. And that kind of makes the production cost bigger. So what happens is the price of your production process goes higher, and the efficiency of your production process becomes lower. And so, as you said, the returns diminish, and you end up using more energy to get the same amount of energy out. And that you kind of find yourself on this treadmill. And so a lot of analysts have been warning about this. So what happened is this kind of all happened at the same time. And we had this kind of focal point on taking Syria as the example. Now, we know that all of those things, when they impacted within Syria locally as a nation, one of the big things that happened is that the food prices, the oil prices, all of these things combined, plus the domestic mismanagement issues within Syria, led to this situation that people couldn't afford food, they couldn't afford bread, they had enough. There was already riots going on elsewhere as well. You know, all of these things were interconnected across the region. People went out on the streets. Bashar al-Assad responded by shooting people in the streets. Some people began picking up arms. Militant groups got involved. Syria has a very geostrategic kind of position in the Middle East for a whole host of reasons, but also in relation to transshipment routes for oil and gas. And everyone basically got involved. The United States got involved, the Gulf states got involved, Britain got involved, France got involved, you know, Russia got involved, Iran got involved, everyone got involved. They all had their narrow geopolitical goals for what they wanted as the outcome. And they funded the people that they wanted to fund. Vast quantities of money went in. Certainly the West played its role. The CIA, MI6, funneled money to the groups they wanted to support. Many of those groups were Islamist militant groups. There was a real, you know, there wasn't, is a real Syrian revolution and democratic core, but it was increasingly hijacked by those militant groups. And it was, and that was in, that process was increasingly empowered by the huge amounts of money and the involvement of kind of the Saudis and, you know, the Gulf states, who, you know, were using essentially the same types of groups that they'd worked with for decades, and bringing those guys in. So you had this acceleration. And then as a result, you know, you had this maelstrom of radicalization, and you had the proliferation of extremist groups, but ultimately, you know, it was like a crucible for the birth of what eventually became ISIS. You know, and it's a complex story, and I don't want to oversimplify that, but I think that's just definitely a reasonable kind of narrative to look at what happened. And of course, once we look at that and we see that, well, this laid the groundwork for the conflict in Syria, this devastating conflict that lasted years, it's still not even finished. It reverberated across the region, and it was played a major role in driving this mass migration. And the vast majority of migrants that were coming from the Middle East from, you know, 2015 onwards were essentially Syrians trying to escape the war. And then you had other things as well. You know, you had the NATO intervention in Libya, which is also catastrophic and also accelerated the role of various militant groups and drove further migration. So, you know, you had all of these things combined, but that mass migration played a massive role in the narrative here, where suddenly you had, you know, essentially ideological cannon fodder for right-wing groups to say, first of all, there was, you know, this existential threat that was being perceived. Wow, we've got all these people coming onto our borders, and they kicked into gear.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, you know, we saw the rise of these figures like Tommy Robinson and some other really just odious figures in Britain and also here in the US.
Absolutely. And I think these things played a really instrumental role in the rise of kind of the extreme wing of the Conservative Party, the rise of specific fringe groups in the UK, like UKIP, for instance, which became the Brexit Party. And in the States, kind of the radicalization of the Republican Party, and this increasing kind of movement towards, well, there's all of this stuff going on, there's this movement of peoples. And you can see what happened when these groups looked at this crisis through the lens that they've always operated on, and they applied that lens, and the solution was otherization. The solution was, these people are the enemy, these people are terrorists, These people are the other. They're bringing in this disgusting ideology, and they're going to change our societies. And they're a threat to our economies. They're a threat, and so we need to have Fortress America, Fortress Europe, and so this played. I think it played a fundamental role, and it wasn't the only role. I mean, there was, you know, we have to look at the fact that there was you know, dark money financing that was coming in. There were various groups mobilizing. All of these things played a role, but I think this played a key role in that process of tipping the system, the political system, into this new state, in a way, where the new equilibrium that's emerged is, well, we have these new right-wing, extreme right narratives, which have now become mainstream, and which have become the politics of the day. And we've seen, in the context of this crisis in Syria and beyond, we've seen multiple governments change. We've seen politics across the world totally transformed. You know, the United States, you know, had the Trump administration. Britain has had the Brexit vote. And since then, we've had this long-running conservative government, which has, you know, similar links to extreme right. We've had multiple governments change in Europe. We've had, you know, we've had the government in Brazil and Philippines. So we've had this fundamental shift in the way politics is operating, and it's a delegitimization of you know, kind of the norms of liberal democracy. And all of that, to some extent, I think you can look at it and you can say, well, we've had this confluence of crises that's going on. And what appears to have happened is, instead of looking at those crises systemically and holistically and really understanding and generating collective, systemic, holistic solutions to them, what we've done is, we've looked at them through the lens of this narrow ideology that some of us have been operating on for decades. And we've diagnosed them, misdiagnosed them through that lens, and created this abortive solution that isn't really going to help us, but it is a kind of a final solution that tends towards this polarization and this demonization of communities. It really can only end up in one kind of radicalization direction. But that direction increasingly kind of disempowers our capability to respond to these very crises. While we're worrying about dealing with black people and dealing with wokeness and dealing with minorities and Muslims and just going crazy about all this stuff, these crises are rumbling along. These fundamental problems that I've spoken about are getting worse, and we're not doing anything about them.
But before you go, I just had one or two more things I wanted to just really briefly touch upon, because I know we're on limited time. Who is maybe benefiting? You mentioned the dark money aspect. Are there certain parties that are benefiting financially or politically from sort of pushing disinformation about COVID, about climate denial? Who's getting the cui bono here? Who benefits?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it's difficult to pin it down to any one particular group. But one of the things that I think is interesting is, for example, how the Koch network always kind of keeps surfacing. In all of the investigations I've been doing, the Koch network kind of lurks behind the scenes and ends up being involved in some way. But just as an example of this, we know that the Koch network has been massively involved, you know, throwing millions, hundreds of millions of dollars at the climate science denial industry. And, you know, they've been doing that, you know, they're also involved and have interlinkages with other groups involved in, you know, tobacco, you know, other health issues, but generally doing disinformation, which is focused on protecting key incumbent industries and kind of moving governments away from the idea that they should be restructuring economies, imposing regulation, holding companies and corporations to account. So, you know, they want to create this kind of extreme unregulated environment for private actors. The same networks keep coming up again and again. So, you know, when I did my investigation into some of the pandemic disinformation that's been going on, like the Great Barrington Declaration, you know, which basically has advocated kind of this so-called focused protection approach, kind of herd immunity, let the virus run, don't have controls, let's just try and protect the elderly and let the virus run through the rest of the population, which now we know that, you know, I mean, when you first hear that, it kind of sounds sensible. I can see why it's appealing to people. But unfortunately, you know, the vast majority of public health scientists And this is reflected, for example, in case listeners aren't aware, the John Snow Memorandum signed by something like over 7,000 public health experts around the world. And that memorandum was published in The Lancet, the top British peer-reviewed medical journal. And they basically said that, look, the problem with this scenario is that it's just impossible to protect the elderly in that way because of the intergenerational issues and the lines of activity between different parts of the population. And that even if you have like a minuscule percentage of that population who then end up getting the virus, then the dynamics will spread, and then you will have hundreds of thousands of millions of deaths of this population. And even though that's a tiny percentage of that population, it's the millions, because we're talking about overall we have very large populations. And that's not to even talk about long COVID and the fact that there's now evidence of 1 in 10 people experiencing kind of long-term symptoms from COVID of all different age groups. But to point out the fact that when I looked into this issue, the Great Barrington Declaration, I found that, it was put out by this, libertarian think tank, the American Institute for Economic Research, that has received funding from the Charles Koch Foundation. It's also received PR support from a PR an agency which has received massive amounts of funding from the Koch Network, and which itself has done massive amounts of propaganda for climate science denying entities in the Koch Network. I mean, you can't make it up. It's like this self-reinforcing feedback loop of Koch, Koch, Koch.
I was going to add too, we don't just, for people that think I know you're mainly focused on what is happening in the UK with this disinformation, but I recently had Ann Nelson on a few months back. She's written about the Council on National Policy, and she just wrote a report for the Washington Spectator on the whole, I forget what the group was called. I think it was America's Frontline Doctors, who were trying to sell a bogus cure for COVID. And, they were in the pocket of these sort of Trump-affiliated right-wingers. So it's really a global phenomena.
Yes, it's really interesting to see how these groups intersect. And what I found quite shocking is how the Koch Network, or the Koch, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it, Koch Network or whatever. I mean, they've ended up turning up in so many different areas. So, I mean, we did a story on this new media venture that's being launched here in the UK, a Fox News style 24-hour news channel called GB News. It's some of your British listeners would have heard of. And it's basically, you have this right-wing establishment here and right-wing journalists who have said we need to have like a far more right-wing TV news channel. And to cut a long story short, ended up finding out that they've received funding from an organization which is very close and has funding from the Koch Network, the Legatum Institute, the Legatum Capital, and so on and so forth. And that kind of thing just ends up recurring again and again. And it's not just, I'm focusing here on one specific example, but what we've found really from looking at this stuff is that you have these intersecting networks of money. You might call it dark money, where it's the Koch Network, you have the Robert and Rebecca Mercer, and you have various groups of this kind who intersect and then are pouring money into these specific campaigns. And what you find is that it's consistently those particular networks funding the same types of intersecting campaigns. So they'll be funding Trump's election campaign, they'll have been funding the Brexit campaign. They were working with Cambridge Analytica disinformation, and they were also doing pandemic disinformation, and they're also funding some of the more far right and extreme right ideologies, and they're pouring money into the kind of xenophobic campaigns. And you see that they're part of this continuum. And so the common denominator then, when we ask who benefits, is that there does seem to be a core group of quite powerful, a powerful group of elite white people who have a very specific view of the world, a very specific view of what they think the world should look like, who are funding some of these things and who were heavily involved in many of the kind of processes that we see unfolding. And I don't think this is by way of being some kind of tightly knit cabal, because even this group is a heterogeneous group. Some of these people are focused on you know, the market and the free market and what that looks like. Some of these people are very concerned about anti-woke, and they're concerned about the makeup of our societies, and they're concerned about identity. Some of these people are concerned about protecting oil and gas interests, and it's all about oil and gas, coal, keeping that show going, fracking. We don't want to have. But what's interesting is how these networks of power have kind of ended up intermingling and intersecting, and that's created a kind of a space for these different ideologies to begin meeting each other and becoming a shared narrative and a shared ideology. And that's, of course, quite dangerous, because what we're seeing is these different disparate ideologies are now part of this self-reinforcing, amplifying feedback loop, and are self-radicalizing each other and feeding into each other. So you have this real spectrum of, you know, someone like David Icke and his crazy anti-Semitic, you know, lizard alien toting kind of worldview, literally intersecting with mainstream Brexit funders, fringe Tory MPs, you know, Trump administration officials, and, you know, kind of pandemic disinformation and climate science denialism. And you know, let's top it off, you know, 5G theories about, you know, the COVID is being spread through 5G. And it just becomes this weird maelstrom of madness.
So last question, I promise to let you go after this. In regards, it sounds like you're saying that part of this crisis is really due, I don't know how else to put it, but capitalism plays a very central role. I'm wondering, would you agree with that assessment? And do you think there's, you know, possibilities for a post-capitalist future?
This is a really good question. It's a difficult one to answer. But I think definitely capitalism is the identity of the economic system that we're operating in. There's no escaping it. I think there's a semantic question as to whether you talk about, is the system that you restructure, is that still a form of capitalism, or is that post-capitalism, or is that anti-capitalism? Personally, I'm not particularly interested in those semantic debates. What's important for me is, what is the nature of the restructuring that needs to take place? I think there's no doubt that one of the key things we're seeing here is that the particular defining structure of capitalism as we understand it, and this is really important because a lot of people don't quite understand what we mean by capitalism. They think capitalism is just a market, or capitalism is just competition, or capitalism is just growth. It's not. Capitalism, in my view, is a very specific relation of production, or to be even more niche about it, you might call it a social property relationship. But it's essentially a relationship where you have the vast majority of people are dispossessed from access to what we might say are, you know, the means of production. And what that essentially means is that there was a time, if we go back in history thousands of years ago, where people were just going around and they had access to, you know, they could access land, food, water, they, you know, could grow it themselves, do it themselves. And the way people made money was you had the aristocrat come and use his sword and say, pay me some, you know, pay me in carrots, or, you know, pay me in this, pay me in that. Now things have changed, because what happened with the dawn of capitalism is that there was this movement to say, we're going to expel you peasants from the land, and you will now have no access to the land. We will now control the land, and all you have to offer is your labor power. And that fundamental kind of rupture creates a whole new dynamic. And that's really important to understand, because the dynamic that that creates goes beyond. There was already, you know, a growth dynamic that we saw linked to greed and all the, and the kind of the feudal structures and things like that, you know, back in the day. But now that becomes more exponential, because in order to survive, the wage laborer has to sell his labor to people who own, you know, these means of producing things, you know, whether it's land, technology, raw materials, blah, 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 blah. And those owners of capital, in order for them to make profits, there's only a limited number of things that they can do. They one either have to depress wages, or they have to improve the technologies to make them more efficient. And so they will then do both. They will, you know, suppress wage labor, they will smash unions, they will do all of that. And if it's too difficult to do so within, you know, the heartlands, they'll go into the peripheries, and they'll go into, you know, where, you know, into the South, and they'll go into the third world or what you want to call it, and they'll find cheaper labor where there's, you know, there's not very much regulation, and that will be great. They will do that. But when that runs out of steam, then okay, let's invest in some technologies and let's increase the efficiency of our production system, and that will allow us to increase our profits. And you end up on this trajectory. In order to survive, you have to keep doing that. And if you don't do that within that system, you will get pushed out, and you will simply, by way of failing to do that, you will get pushed out of the market and you will fail. So there's this exponential growth trajectory driving this. So what we're seeing within this capitalist framework is that there are these systemic pressures which are driving this constant need to expand, this constant need to get more and more resources, more and more cheaper labor, more and more improvement of technologies, more and more efficiency. And we're going down this kind of trajectory. There's no
one. And it's completely unsustainable.
It's unsustainable, because how are you going to sustain this demand for endless continuous growth? It has to keep growing within a system which is essentially finite. You know, we have a limited resource base. We have limited labor. At some point, it doesn't work. It has to crash. And specifically, what we're seeing now is the system is using, because of the real economy, we can't grow it anymore within the constraints of the system and within the planetary boundaries that we see. We're seeing this increasing reliance on debt and this increasing financialization, increasing creation of ingenious instruments of credit by which to allow things to continue. Even now in the pandemic, we're seeing we have to resort to, let's create more debt mechanisms, let's print more money, let's print our way out of this crisis, and blah, 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 blah. Now, all of this looks really bleak, and you're kind of thinking, how is this going to end? Where does this go? How do we disrupt this?
I was going to say, I mean, is there any hope? Is there any reason for optimism?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. It's a really important one. And there is hope. And apart from the fact that there is a huge scientific literature that's emerged, which shows that we have the key ideas, we have the key technologies, we have the key kind of economic solutions and restructuring solutions for how we actually reorganize our systems in order to get to one which works. And of course, the window and the window of opportunity to do that is rapidly closing when we look at the evidence around dangerous climate change and the risks around pandemics and the risks around a collapsing energy system and all of this kind of stuff. Of course, it seems overwhelming. But one of the things that has happened is I've been recently working for a think tank called RethinkX, which some people may have heard of. RethinkX is a technology forecasting group, which has been, and I don't agree with everything that RethinkX have said or forecasted. But one of the really critical insights that they bring to the table that isn't understood is that just in the same way, when we're looking at these complex system dynamics in climate change, in human systems, and we're seeing that, you know, there are these long periods of equilibrium and they're punctuated by these rapid, abrupt changes. So climate change often is seen as this gradual linear process, but we're increasingly seeing that actually what really happens in climate systems is that we have these rapid events which are triggered, and they change the whole climate system into a new phase state, and there's no kind of going back. And what we're learning is that the same kinds of processes are also happening in technology. So, and there's three key sectors where we're seeing some really exciting technology disruptions, which are going to change the game and are already changing the game in many ways. So we're looking at energy, food, and transport. And I would suggest to go and check out some of the research at RethinkX.com and look at some of the work that we've been putting out over the last 4 years in these sectors, which have shown that solar, wind, and battery in the energy sector, transport system, you know, we're looking at electric vehicles, and the way in which there will be a disruption even to individual car ownership. And thirdly, in food, they're talking about the potential for precision fermentation, which is we don't need to rely on kind of dairy farming. There's the potential for kind of lab-grown meats and all of this kind of stuff. Now, what's really interesting about what they're saying is that empirically, when we look at the data, the conventional view is that technological change takes place slowly and incrementally and in the same kind of incremental fashion. And what they're saying is that's just not the case. And we can see clear examples of this. So when we transition from horses to the automobile. We had a series of these key technology convergences which enabled the automobile to, and the fundamental change took place in 13 years. So, you know, the early 20th century, you had people saying, there's no way that these idiots driving around in their cars, tinkering with their vehicles, are going to take over. Horses are here to stay. And within 13 years, no one was going around with a horse. Completely disappeared. Same thing kind of happened with digital cameras, right? You know, we had, you know, there was a time when it was like Kodak ruled the world, analog cameras. Then the digital camera innovation within, again, the space of just over a decade, Kodak just collapsed and you had digital cameras everywhere. And smartphones have also done a similar kind of thing in the way that they've transformed and revolutionized the world. So what these guys are saying is that some of these technologies in these key sectors, and they say these are foundational sectors of production. They're not just kind of peripheral sectors, they're fundamental to how our civilization works. They're basically going through these cost curve declines, which we've already seen. So for example, like Tony Sieber, who was one of the founders, for years was predicting solar wind, solar technology, the cost curve declines would be dramatic. They'd become cost competitive really soon. And I broke the story a few years ago for Vice, where he wrote a book, and this was before they even founded RethinkX. And I broke the story and put it out there. And those of people were like, no, there's no way solar's gonna go that fast, and blah, blah, blah. And he was absolutely correct. And now we're finding that already solar, wind, and battery is becoming cost competitive with fossil fuels. And that trajectory is only going to accelerate with time. Now, the same things are arguably happening in these other sectors, in transport and in precision fermentation. Now, there's a debate to be had about how far some of these things can go. Do we really want them to be rolled out? What about, you know, regenerative agriculture? And there's also legitimate caveats that we can bring in about what are the implications of rolling out these new technologies? What about the mineral requirements? What about, you know, the materials footprint and all of that kind of stuff? But one of the interesting things, that there's two key things to get here. One is that the disruptions are taking place far faster than anticipated. And we're looking at these cost curve declines happening within the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, and they've already started, when solar, wind, and battery and electric vehicles have already started. And Tony Sieber and Jamie Arbuckle, who I've been working with, have been saying, for example, that all these governments are banning petrol cars from 2030. And they're saying, I mean, they can do that if they want, but the vehicles are going to be cost competitive with petrol. EVs will be cost competitive with petrol vehicles, you know, within a few years. It's already happening. And already now we have some of the major kind of automobile kind of industry kind of players recognizing this happening and saying, wow, this is actually happening much faster than anticipated. So the good news is that we have these technologies rolling out, and just due to the pure economics, a lot of these technologies, especially these three fundamental ones, they are very likely to become much cheaper than some of these incumbent industries, not just within our lifetimes, but like within this decade, it's going to happen. That doesn't mean that we're out of the gate. One, because we know that climate change is happening far. We might already be in the danger zone in climate change. Hell, we might have already crossed and it might be too late. Those are uncertainties that we just don't know. But what we do know is that we now, knowing that we have these technologies and that theoretically when we roll out and model them, there are ways to make them truly sustainable. We can apply circular economy principles. We can make sure that we're applying the best kind of clean kind of production principles across these sectors to ensure that we roll them out in the right way. We look at decentralized ownership structures, you know, change the intellectual property laws. So there's lots of critical things to do where we can reorganize our societies to make sure that these technologies are rolled out in a way that benefits everybody.
And that is equitable to all.
That is equitable to all, that ushers in a new way of organizing our societies that's participatory. That's the challenge that we have. But I think the good news is that this is not just possible. A lot of these technologies are going to become far more kind of viable, you know, as we're speaking, it's happening right now. So the challenge is what we need to remember, that there is hope. There's a, and just to really kind of hit that home. something like 85%. I mean, I'm currently working on research now with these guys. 85% of all global emissions are linked to these three fundamental sectors. So if we can actually roll out these sectors within 15 years and with the cost curve declines, this stops being some kind of difficult thing and actually becomes something that is being propelled by the economics. And if the disruptions like the smartphone and the automobile or anything to go by digital cameras, this is something that can actually happen due to the way technologies actually roll out and due to the mechanics of that process. So we actually have real grounds for hope that we can solve this. So we have this 15-year period where we're being told by, you know, the IPCC and, you know, and scientists who are saying that IPCC is conservative. With, you know, we have this 5 to 10-year, 15-year period where this is it. We need to make this work. Crisis is coming. This is the danger zone. But we also have this emerging evidence that we've got all the technologies that we need. We don't need breakthrough fusion technologies. We don't need some kind of space age stuff that's going to come in 30 years. And we don't need exotic carbon drawdown technologies, which don't work. Which don't work right now, which are commercially not viable, that the IPCC is factoring into their things. What we need is to focus on the technologies we do have and accelerate their rollout, and focus also on what's the kind of restructuring of societies that we need to create an equal and fair distributed world, which is what these technologies are geared towards. They're not really designed. Their design isn't, like fossil fuels is inherently a centralized resource, but solar, wind and battery, this is inherently conducive to distribution, decentralization, household, community ownership. So this is the kind of vision that we have. And what's really exciting is in our grasp. So what we need to do as communities and activists is not only raise awareness of this potential, but to upskill ourselves in these sectors, to upskill ourselves in thinking about what this kind of new civilization will look like, and to work towards what that means in terms of, you know, an entirely new human being, because we're moving into it. The possibilities that this opens up is a distributed world where we're operating on the basis of ethical values, where instead of saying it's all about me and it's all about endless growth for its own sake, we're talking about a world which inherently is working in harmony with the environment, where economic prosperity works in tandem with protecting and conserving animal life, and so on and so forth. And that's the kind of paradigm that we want to see coming into existence. And it means that there's an opportunity to change our perceptions of the world, change our perceptions of who we are, fundamentally transform our organizing and social systems and political systems. And that's the opportunity that we have. And I think the biggest thing that I've learned in this process of working with these guys is that when these technologies unfold and they become cost competitive, the biggest thing of all is that it means that the incumbent industries, they cannot survive. And that's the kind of key. You know, when the smartphone came along, we didn't want to use the old brick phones. It's just, they just disappeared. And it's the same kind of thing. You know, once the automobile came along, no one was using horses. These technologies, when they're rolled out in the right way, no one's going to need to use oil and gas. No one's going to want to kind of rely on cows for meat. No one's going to want to drive their individually owned cars, because they'll be happy with the limited number of EVs that are then driving around. And that's going to have massive effects on our material footprint. You know, if we're not shipping around oil and gas, you know, in rail, you know, and coal in railways and shipping lanes, and not transporting massive quantities of meat, what's that going to change in terms of the amount of shipping? You know, 30 to 40% of shipping is oil. You know, if we're losing all of the oil and gas shipping, we won't need to have all of that transport, all of that logistics, all of those pipelines, all of that steel disappears, the need for it. So we're talking about the possibility of bringing in a world with a much lighter footprint on the planet by using and harnessing these technologies. So I think that now is the time to really crucially kind of educate ourselves about these issues, educate ourselves about systems, societies, and moving ourselves into a space where we can really think, what do I have to offer this new world that can come into being? What's my role as an agent of change? And to see that in this in this phase shift that we're going through, which is going to happen, not only is there massive possibility, but we now have as individuals huge power in a way that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have had, because all of these systems and structures that are bound to these incumbencies, they're extremely weak. They're basically, what we're experiencing now is this process of collapse. The old order is dying. It's slowly crumbling away. And that's why there's we're seeing these death throes of ideological tantrums and you this and you that. And this is all an eruption from this fundamental breakdown and weakness. It's a system that will not survive and cannot survive, not only this century, but I believe in the next few decades, it won't be able to survive. That doesn't mean that we won't, it's quite possible we might just collapse in the next 20, 30 years, you know. But I think that we've got this unprecedented opportunity, and there is this massive moment of uncertainty. And it's in those uncertainties that we find ourselves as individuals with suddenly this huge ability to change things and to have power. So that's the key, I think, recognizing that we do have power as individuals in our communities, in our societies. And the question is, I think each of us can sit back and say, what do I have to offer? Where do I need to improve myself? Where do I have to upskill myself and upgrade myself? And what can I then bring, not just in an abstract way to the world out there, but really, you know, to my context, to my communities, to my family, to the structures that I operate in? What can I bring to that in terms of change?
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Nafees Ahmed, for staying a little bit over time and for just being such an insightful guest on Parallax Views. Let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work. Byline Times, correct?
Absolutely. So I'm writing a lot for bylinetimes.com at the moment, which is a publication in Britain. It is quite UK focused at the moment, but I do some global stuff, but it's very much tracking disinformation, the alt-right, the far-right, politics, that kind of stuff. I'm doing some systems. I do a lot of systems reporting at my column at Vice. So you can check that out. I mean, it's the science magazine at Vice, Motherboard. So I'm not writing for them as regularly at the moment, just because I've been pulled into a lot of this kind of reactionary stuff, because Britain is going kind of crazy at the moment with this kind of crazy anti-woke weird. I mean, like, we just published this race report saying that there's no such thing as institutional racism. This was by the government. So we're kind of like it's like the Trump regime kind of moved to the UK. So we're kind of dealing with that at the moment. But I'm really committed to doing this stuff. I've also got a crowdfunded platform, Insert Intelligence. And I fund this via my Patreon account. It's patreon.com/Nafees, N-A-F-E-E-Z. So people can come along there. I post all my work there regularly. And most of that is public. So people can come to that. And you know, even if you don't want to sign up to the crowdfund, you can come there and kind of get regular updates. And I'm also, as I said, I'm consulting for RethinkX at the moment and doing a lot of research, working on videos. And that stuff is slow burn stuff. It won't come out straight away, but you can keep an eye. And we'll be putting out some really exciting materials in the coming months. And of course, I mean, you know, check out NafeesAhmed.net, just, you know, that's my general kind of website.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Nafees Ahmed, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, JD.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Nafees Ahmed. Please be sure to keep up with his work at the Byline Times. Really great stuff. I think he's a very, very insightful thinker and analyst, more than worth keeping up with. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Brian, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.